Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sharon Kelly of Human Rights First, who examines Vice President Cheney's recent admission that he authorized the torture of terrorist suspects held by the U.S. at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base and elsewhere. Nicholas Ahrens, co-founder of Islands First, who assesses the grave threat posed by global warming to small island states. And Carrie Davidson of the group Equality California, who explains the angry reaction around the nation to Barack Obama's selection of evangelical pastor Rick Warren to deliver the invocation at his January inauguration. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Healthcare workers in Zimbabwe are worried the recent cholera outbreak that has killed 800 people has overshadowed the demise of the country's healthcare system and the hundreds of people who die every day from AIDS. The cholera epidemic was caused by the flow of sewage in the southern African nation. Zimbabwe has been in crisis over the fate of President Mugabe, economic sanctions, and the failure of the power-sharing agreement made with opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. According to the Guardian newspaper, 400 people in Zimbabwe died of AIDS every day because they lack key medicines and nutrition. The Mugabe regime has blocked many international non-governmental aid organizations from reaching the nation's most vulnerable people. Life expectancy in the country is one of the lowest in the world. Maine and Nicoli of Doctors Without Borders Belgium, who was working in Zimbabwe, observed a weakened population that is undernourished, a population that has a high HIV prevalence, is even more at risk from cholera. Lisa Jackson, nominated by Barack Obama to be the next administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, had previously run New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection. Critics charge that she has been too close to industry, has failed to reform the state's tarnished toxic cleanup program, and not willing to listen to agency whistleblowers. Jackson's most vocal critic is the group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, PEER. They have blasted the nominee for failing to adopt a new cleanup standard for 16,000 toxic waste sites in New Jersey. Last summer, the EPA's Inspector General harshly criticized the New Jersey Toxic Waste Program for going easy on polluters and failing to leverage enough resources from the EPA. New Jersey environmentalists do not blame Jackson personally for all these problems. Eco-activists cite the job cuts in the state's toxic cleanup program made by former Governor Christine Todd Whitman, the former EPA administrator, and political pressure from Governor John Corzine to name pro-industry people to key environmental posts. Florida tomato pickers won a historic agreement in early December with Connecticut-based Subway, the third largest fast food chain in the country, to pay workers an extra penny per pound of tomatoes. The agreement with the 4,000-member coalition of Immokalee workers comes after other key agreements with McDonald's, Burger King, and Yum! Brands, owners of Taco Bell. The Subway agreement is a major coup since it is the largest fast food buyer of Florida tomatoes. The agreement was struck just before tomato workers and their allies planned a march on Subway's corporate headquarters in Milford, Connecticut. Farm workers and their labor allies are now planning to target national supermarket chains to boost wages for Florida tomato pickers. The agreement will mean tomato pickers can earn 72 to 77 cents for every 32-pound basket of tomatoes harvested, up from 40 to 45 cents. Yet, the money from these agreements with fast food companies has not reached the tomato pickers. According to the Miami Herald, the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange has refused to cooperate, leaving funds sitting in bank accounts collecting interest and not in the pockets of farm workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
A report from the Senate Armed Services Committee, parts of which were released on December 11th, found that former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other top Bush administration officials are directly responsible for the torture and abuse of American-held detainees. The bipartisan committee asserts that the White House authorized interrogation methods that included waterboarding, stress positions, sexual humiliation, isolation, sleep deprivation, exposure to heat and cold, and the use of dogs to intimidate prisoners at Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba, military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, and secret CIA prisons around the world. In a December 15th interview with ABC News reporter Jonathan Carl, Vice President Dick Cheney admitted that he had personally cleared the way for the U.S. military to employ abusive interrogation techniques against terrorist suspects. Cheney was unapologetic about approving the use of waterboarding on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, accused of being a key al-Qaeda planner of the 9/11 attacks. President Bush issued a memo on February 7, 2002, which declared that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to al-Qaeda or Taliban detainees. Both Bush and Cheney say the abuse of prisoners was necessary to keep the nation safe. Chair of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Carl Levin, Democrat of Michigan, said that the Senate report on torture will be turned over to President-elect Obama's Department of Justice. He suggested that an outside commission be formed with subpoena power, which could lead to indictments or civil action. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sharon Kelly, coordinator of Human Rights First's We Can End Torture campaign. She examines the Senate committee report and explains the importance of keeping American officials accountable for violations of U.S. and international law.
Pretty remarkably, what we've seen after this report's release, all during the past week, was a pretty bold reaction from the Vice President's office. Vice President Cheney came out of the silence that he'd been keeping since the election to do a series of interviews where he really made a full-throated endorsement of the Bush administration's policies on torture. But in terms of step forward, I mean, accountability is clearly something that we need to see. And when we have the Vice President saying in interviews this past week that he has no regrets about the decisions that he made and would, you know, make the same decisions again, that's something that we're hoping that the next Justice Department will be looking into. But there's also some policy changes that need to happen in an Obama administration. We hope that President Obama could be renouncing torture in his inaugural address to make clear that his administration is going to be taking a new course. We'd like to see a single standard of humane treatment across all government agencies, so that means no exception for the CIA. We'd like to see a reaffirmation of the commitment to fully comply with the Geneva Conventions. Another initiative that we think could really help clean up the torture problem would be to guarantee Red Cross access to all prisoners in the custody of U.S. intelligence agencies, so no more secret prisons. Also an end to extraordinary rendition. So there's a series of steps to reform the policy, and then we also need to clearly take a look at what happened so we can make sure that we don't ever see a repeat of the, you know, the disastrous road we've been down the past 8 years.
As you mentioned, Vice President Dick Cheney has gone public with his admission that he authorized this torture and was proud of it. And, of course, he justifies that on the basis of we needed to take these extraordinary measures to keep the nation safe. He's already said several times, as well as other allies of the Bush administration, that torture techniques actually prevented future terrorist attacks by waterboarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others. The U.S. discovered plots to attack this country. What do you make of these claims, first of all? Is there any veracity to these claims, which I know have been contradicted by others in the U.S. intelligence services? But beyond that, is there any way, even if there was a bit of truth to these claims, would that justify torture in your mind?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, the claims that Vice President Cheney is making that torture has somehow prevented attacks on United States soil, you know, he doesn't really provide the data to go at his underlying claims. However, it is significant that expert interrogators are unanimous or nearly unanimous in saying that torture does not work to produce actionable intelligence. In fact, just this week in Vanity Fair, the FBI director, Robert Mueller, is interviewed and says that he does not believe that torture prevented any attacks on the United States. There's also two recent books that I would draw your attention to. One is by Matthew Alexander and one is by Eric Maddox. And those are two interrogators who served in Iraq. And really, interestingly, they tell the stories of how the two most wanted men in Iraq, Saddam Hussein and al-Zarqawi, were caught without resorting to coercive techniques. So while we aren't able to assess, you know, whether Vice President Cheney's claims about preventing attacks are true because the evidence he's relying on is classified, we do know that we have ways to disrupt terrorist plots and keep American troops and American interests safe without resorting to torture.
Senator Levin, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, which issued this report, has said that a special commission should be formed to investigate White House officials' authorization of torture and possibly recommend prosecution in the future. Do you think that's the way to go, or should there be sort of a task force set up under the incoming Attorney General, Eric Holder? Do you think the Attorney General really should take the initiative to investigate this and prosecute if need be when Mr. Obama and his team take office in January?
I think there's a two-part interest for Americans and for the government here. I mean, one is we need to understand what happened so we can make sure that it never happens again. And two, as part of making sure that we don't go down this road again, there needs to be accountability for people that may have committed crimes. So Human Rights First has been calling for both a full investigation and then, if this investigation would lead to evidence of criminal wrongdoing, prosecutions. Torture is not a policy choice. I mean, we don't want to be seeing this debated every 4 years, every 8 years, as just a difference that some politicians may have with one another. Torture is illegal. You know, it's been illegal. Vice President Cheney, when he defended waterboarding, you know, seems to forget that we prosecuted people for waterboarding in the past as a war crime. So, you know, if criminal activity occurred, people need to be held accountable.
That was Sharon Kelly, coordinator of Human Rights First's We Can End Torture campaign. Contact the group by calling area code 212-845-5200 or visit their website at humanrightsfirst.org. In the first 12 days of December, environment ministers from 150 nations and other leaders, including UN Chief Ban Ki-moon and representatives of U.S. President-elect Barack Obama, gathered in Poznan, Poland, to work on a draft of the successor document to the Kyoto Climate Change Treaty to be signed in Copenhagen next year. The treaty is scheduled to take effect in 2012. Among the delegates in Poland were representatives from dozens of small island nations, which have been the first to feel the catastrophic impacts of climate change. While holding out hope for improvements to the proposed treaty under the incoming Obama administration, many environmentalists and representatives of these island nations were disappointed by the tepid response of participating countries to already existing climate disruption and the more severe changes expected to come. The best news to come out of the Poznan meeting was the European Union's so-called 20-20-20 deal, which seeks to decrease greenhouse emissions, energy savings, and increase renewable energy sources each by 20% by the year 2020. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nicholas Ahrens, co-founder of Islands First, an organization that assists small island states to increase their influence at the United Nations in their fight against global warming. He discusses the disruptions that have already occurred on these islands due to global warming and their people's hopes for averting more catastrophic damage and displacement.
Basically, what's happening is while most of the world, the developed world and the first world, is talking about the future impact of climate change and what's going to be happening in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, there are countries that are already experiencing the first major impacts of climate change, and that's places like the Maldives and Tuvalu and Vanuatu, where they're experiencing rising sea levels that are beginning to destroy their freshwater reserves, that are salinating their crops, killing taro fields. And one thing that affects most small islands, their coral reefs are starting to bleach because of increasing acidic levels in the ocean, which is also many people believe caused by carbon being emitted into the atmosphere. So places like the Maldives and Tuvalu are starting to figure out what are they going to do when the seas have risen too high, and they're starting to form agreements with neighboring countries. They're starting funds for which are called adaptation funds, but in reality they are refugee funds for what to do when they have to leave. And this did coincide, a lot of this, with what was happening in Poznan. And what the islands felt is that signing on to the current agreement, which will be next negotiated in Copenhagen, is basically a suicide pact, because it says we are not going to do anything drastic enough to save these islands. And they feel that that's a kick in the stomach, because basically they're being asked to accept their own demise. And so many believe that that's not something they're willing to accept. So there's been increased activism by the small island states to have their voices heard, to say, look, if we are countries too, we are members of the United Nations, and it's not fair for the rest of the world, which is the part of the world that actually has caused the problem. The large, wealthy nations that emit so much carbon are the ones causing the problems, and the small islands emit almost no carbon. They're the first ones affected by climate change, and they are basically doing everything they can because this is a matter of life and death for them.
There was a lot of coverage in the last couple of weeks about the climate discussions in Poznan, Poland.
While the whole world focused on Poland, which was, in my opinion, a fairly big waste of time, in New York, a bunch of small island states led by Palau's ambassador Stuart Beck got together and demanded that the Security Council do something about climate change. And they're doing this in a very interesting way. They've circulated a General Assembly resolution asking the Security Council to take up climate change again. This would be the second time that the Security Council explicitly took up climate change. And this time, the difference is small island countries are asking the Security Council to do this because they're saying, look, if you care about security, and the work of the Council is to protect the world when there are security threats, there's no greater threat right now to the livelihoods and the lives and the future of these islands than climate change. And so it is an issue of security. And so far there's been a lot of resistance, but also a lot of agreement. And so there's, I think, over 60 co-sponsor nations right now to the small island states resolution.
A group of small island nations at the Poznan conference signed on to the demand that the level of CO2 in the atmosphere be reduced to 350 parts per million, which is quite a bit lower than it currently is. And that's the level that leading climate scientist James Hansen says is required to save life on Earth.
Very few people listened to him, but the small islands, who probably have the biggest ears for this issue, because like I said, they're the ones who are most affected by it, have taken up the 350 number and are really pushing it very hard, because they know that unless the world's emissions get down to 350 parts per million of carbon, there is no future for them.
Are the islands in the Pacific more threatened than in other places, say in the Caribbean?
I think every small island is very affected. I don't want to say one is worse than off than the other. I just think that in the immediate term, the Pacific and obviously the Indian Ocean states as well are the ones who are really reeling from the effects, who are actually experiencing, as I said, these immediate threats where their fresh water is being taken over by salt water, and where literally erosion is actually starting to take homes, and this is something that they've never seen. And these cultures date back thousands of years. Many have actually developed largely apart from the rest of the world, and for them to have to face the possibility of relocating is a pretty big blow.
You mentioned that the European Union has signed on to the General Assembly resolution to get the Security Council to seriously take up climate change as a security issue. What about the U.S.?
The United States hasn't, but I have to hope that with the new administration they'd be more interested.
What about Hawaii? Our new president has a very personal connection there.
That's correct. He does, and we're really hoping that that connection makes him more sympathetic to the fate of the small island states and more interested in doing everything he can urgently. And everything that I see him doing suggests that he is.
That was Nick Ahrens of Islands First. Contact the group by calling their interim director, Leila Kazemi, at area code 917-797-0923, or visit their website at islandsfirst.org. When President-elect Barack Obama announced his selection of evangelical pastor Reverend Rick Warren to deliver the invocation at his inauguration, there was immediate negative reaction by many Obama supporters who object to Reverend Warren's outspoken opposition to abortion and gay rights. But the anger wasn't quite felt so deeply as it was among California's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, where Reverend Warren and his Saddleback mega church actively backed California Proposition 8, which won voter support to overturn the state Supreme Court's May 15th ruling legalizing gay marriage. In selecting Reverend Warren, Mr. Obama cited his friendship with a pastor and his influence in calling on Christians to become more active in combating poverty, global warming, and AIDS. Equality California is one of the groups that worked hard to defeat Proposition 8. The group's executive director, Jeff Kors, described Obama's choice of Rick Warren to give the invocation as appalling and wrote a statement explaining why he decided to decline the invitation to attend the inauguration ceremonies on January 20th. Some gay rights groups took their unhappiness with the Rick Warren controversy to press Mr. Obama to take quick action on protecting the rights of LGBT citizens when he takes office. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Carrie Davidson, board president of Equality California, who explains the angry reaction to Reverend Rick Warren's participation in the Obama inauguration and the steps now being taken by his and other groups to overturn the Proposition 8 ban on gay marriage.
Well, and especially in California, we've had a tough time since Election Day because, well, so many people were celebrating the election of President-elect Obama, we were witnessing the passage of Proposition 8. And because we've been in a mood that is not entirely happy, this just added to our disappointment. We've seen voters go against LGBT Californians, and now we've witnessed the president-elect who was campaigning on hope and change and inclusion select a person to give the invocation who preaches exclusion. He doesn't even allow gay people to be members of his congregation. He allows you to attend, but you can't become a member.
Give us some of the details, being on the ground there in California, about the role that Reverend Rick Warren and his Saddleback Church played in this whole drive to pass Proposition 8.
Proposition 8 is one component, and Reverend Warren is the pastor to a very large congregation. I think it numbers more than 20,000 people. And he urged his congregation and other people who read what he publishes to get out and encourage everyone to vote yes on Proposition 8. And so it's not as if he was just on the sidelines, but he took a leadership role in asking the members, other congregation, to be active participants in going against a minority group, and to take away the right that we had recently been granted to be able to marry in this state.
Well, Carrie, I wanted to ask you to give us an update now on the struggle that you have been a part of there at Equality California against the result of the vote on Proposition 8 in November. There's some recent news about former California governor, now California Attorney General, Jerry Brown, asking California's Supreme Court to overturn the voter approval of Proposition 8. Tell us more about that, if you would.
Just by way of background, on the day following the election, a number of organizations with Equality California as the organizational plaintiff filed a brief with the Supreme Court asking it to overturn Proposition 8 on the basis that it shouldn't have been presented to the voters because it wasn't a regular constitutional amendment and was in fact a revision of our Constitution, which required legislative approval before it was submitted to the voters. What Attorney General Brown has done is weighed in as the Attorney General and said there are inalienable rights that cannot be presented to the voters for ratification, and in this case, rejection. And the right to marry is one of them. And while he said, yes, it's appropriate to have a constitutional amendment that this right that was allegedly taken away from us by the voters should never have been presented to the voters, and is asking the Supreme Court to nullify Prop 8 in that regard.
Is the strategy of groups like yours, Equality California, and others mostly in the courts now, or are there other tactics that you're taking to overturn the voters' decision on Proposition 8?
Well, certainly the first step is with the court, which is why we filed something the day after the election. And we can be hopeful. We have in the legislature resolutions saying that the legislature is in favor of the repeal of Prop 8 and asking the Supreme Court to do that. We're joined by the mayors in our largest cities and the city councils, the cities themselves, in doing that. So that's an initial push. If the court comes through and repeals Prop 8, then we anticipate a backlash against the justices, and we vote on justices in our state, and we will definitely support those against any type of recall or those who are up for retention who voted on our side. If it turns out that the Supreme Court doesn't vote to void Prop 8, then we can and are looking at opportunities to go to the voters again with something that will enable us to once again be able to marry.
That was Carrie Davidson, Board President of Equality California. Contact the group by calling area code 415-581-0005 or visit their website at eqca.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.